The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right. Welcome to The Matthew Aaron Show. www.thematthewaronshow.com. Matthew Aaron Show on iTunes. Thank you to all our subscribers that are running on a treadmill right now and bored out of their mind and have nothing else to listen to but us. And
do you think we have a lot of treadmill using?
Yeah, I know we do. Okay. I know we do. I get a bunch of emails saying I was jogging listening to your show.
Okay.
And I go, that is not what I would be doing while I'm jogging.
Right. You are. So you were running from us the other day. But we could not, you couldn't get away.
Yeah, at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter, Matthew Aaron on Facebook. But I always say Matthew Aaron on Facebook, but my account's private, so people can't find me.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm teasing people.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, come find me on Facebook.
Right. Right.
I'm here with my partner here.
Lee Capreas, hello. And I'll say Lee Capreas on Facebook, and my account is not private. So if you're if you're turned off by the exclusiveness of Matt's Facebook, be my friend. Friend me. Follow me on Twitter.
I got too many friends on Facebook, man. I can't do it anymore. I don't want random people adding me anymore. I hate to sound like I'm important or something. I'm not. It's not that. It's just then you got random people commenting on all your stuff. And my Facebook's pretty open. I'm pretty personal on my Facebook, so I don't want like random people reading my my problem.
Well, what I do is I have people you know, that have requests, and I don't deny or accept them right away. What I do is I keep them on there for a while, and then one night when I've had like two or three too many glasses of wine, I go through it and I really think about it, and then I accept. I kind of make a little ritual out of adding or denying strangers, which I am not against.
Well, I think that's good. Good for you.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever floats your boat.
All right.
I do want to say I just got a message on Facebook from a listener who says Cindy Cohen's hot.
Wow. Okay.
So that's for Cindy. She's already got some fans out there.
Oh.
Let's see, what else do we got going on? Do we want to just start with Cindy, or do we want to kick off with last night? I know we watched them. Well, let's talk about the movies we watched real quick.
Yeah, all right. So we watched
Sorcerer. Woman's Secret.
A Nicholas Ray film. Nicholas Ray movie with
Maureen O'Hara. Written by Herman Mankiewicz.
Right. That was, I think, one of his earlier movies. Not really up there with On Dangerous Ground or Bigger Than Life, but it was all right. And what we wanted to talk about was Sorcerer, the William Friedkin movie with Roy Scheider. Roy Scheider in his prime.
Yeah. 78, I believe.
Not about a sorcerer or sorcery at all, but in fact it's a remake of the
Wages of Fear.
Of the Wages of Fear by Henri Georges Clouseau.
Which I haven't seen and you have, and
I have on DVD, it's very good. And the Sorcerer is good, but it's rated PG. And in the first 10 minutes, there is a bombing in a Middle Eastern country,
yep.
A stick-up at a church, a heist. With a priest getting shot.
blood everywhere.
Yeah. Just after the first act, an oil fire explodes.
With the charred bodies.
Charred bodies.
What would you say? It was like a rock concert. What were you saying? The crowd surf. Crowd surfing.
Yeah, charred bodies, crowd surf, yeah.
PG.
PG, yeah. PG. And you know what? I gotta say, Sorcerer often makes a nice double bill with Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules.
Well,
or 77 that was made. What was a PG movie out when that was made? So that's a
Jaws.
Nice, that's double bill with, that was 75. With Star Wars. That's
Star
PG,
Wars,
yeah, PG.
Okay.
Or Watership Down.
Well, you know what it was, is in, I believe it was 84, 85, Temple of Doom was the first PG-13 film.
Uh-huh.
So they didn't have PG-13 at the time.
Yeah.
So I guess Sorcerer wasn't R enough.
That was PG-13?
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense because they're tearing the guy's heart out. that's not PG material, but I don't feel like that's R material. By today's standards, maybe.
One of our fans said we need to give out spoiler alerts before we talk about 30-year-old movies.
Oh, God.
Look, if you haven't seen Sorcerer yet, I don't think I should be giving out spoiler alerts.
No, and I tell you something, I am pro-spoiler in some cases, and I'm not going to get into that, but...
Yeah, please don't. I'm all. Please don't. Okay, well, I want to bring in our guest right away. She is a executive producer of the film that is premiering at Sundance this year. We're very, very lucky to have her. It stars Robert De Niro. It stars Sigourney Weaver, Elizabeth Olsen, Cillian Murphy. Isn't it correct?
Nope.
Yep. Okay, so I do want to bring in Cindy Cohen, who is, she's got quite the resume that we're going to get into. But how excited are you for Sundance? You're premiering.
We're premiering with a big Friday night premiere. Hope to see you guys there.
Straighten
if you're
up
there.
The mic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and we're not going to get to see it for a while. Explain how Sundance works. We were just talking about this. You take the movie there, and basically what you're going to do is show it to an audience, but in that audience is probably going to be distributors and studios. And what do? They bid on the movie then, right?
I do my movies different than some producers do. I like to hold back domestic as my upside. And if I'm capable of financing a movie without giving domestic away, that's what I do. So we'll use a festival as prestigious as Sundance to debut the movie. And when we say we're premiering it, it's the first time the movie will be shown to anybody.
Wow.
And then hopefully with the buzz of my actors sitting there and my directors sitting there, we will start a bidding war with somebody that hopefully can handhold the movie and do it justice.
Yeah, well, before we get into what the movie is about and everything, I want people to know what you're dealing with listening to Cindy here. This resume is pretty great. I mean, okay, you did Rent a Kid. That was like what? That was 15 years ago or so with Leslie Nielsen, right? And then If These Walls Could Talk on HBO with Demi Moore and Cher and who else was in? And then there was
Sissy Spacek and Hesh.
Oh, yeah. And there was a sequel, right?
Yes. Yeah. We just did the first one.
You just did the first one. Okay. And then one of my favorite movies ever, you did Traffic, which I want to get into. Mm-hmm. And you did Savior with a buddy of mine, Dennis Quaid, who's great.
Right.
But let's start out with, how did you get involved in producing? Because we were talking outside, and you're like, I didn't know what I wanted to be as a kid. And so what got you into the business and the producing end of things? I think it's an interesting backstory from what I know. And I was wondering if you could add on.
I got into this business quite different than most people got into it. I have a degree in psychology, and I took that infamous year off that people should never take, that your parents say don't take. I did.
Backpacking in Europe.
That was it. fell in love with the lead singer of a band and needed a night job, and considering my parents spent a lot of money putting me through college, I figured I shouldn't be a waitress. And so the only night job I could figure out at the time that wasn't too obnoxious to go into was getting a job in news. And so I ended up being one of the associate producers to a CBS affiliate in Miami, Florida. And that's kind of where I learned producing, although I learned it in quite a different way than most people. Strangely, I stayed at CBS for about a year. And if anybody knows anything about news, you get people that call in with these late-breaking stories, and if you're the one on the phone, that story is yours. And in my particular case, there was a little boy's head that actually was decapitated that was floating, and this is going to take it in a whole nother way. It was floating down the intercoastal in Hollywood, Florida, a place where nothing bad happens, and it turned out that the father worked for my father at his hotel as a pool man. And they wanted me to cover the story. Out of the respect to the family, I didn't want to. I didn't think it was appropriate. I ended up getting in a fight with my news chief at that time. I refused to cover it. It bought the father probably about 24 hours before anybody else went there. Ironically, the father went on to start a show called America's Most Wanted.
John Walsh is your story?
John Walsh is my story, and the little boy was Adam Walsh, and that changed the course of my career.
Wow.
So it's very strange, and I ended up briefly as a songwriter, believe it or not.
Is this when you were dating the rock and roll man?
When I was dating the rock and roll man.
I'm surprised that story she broke didn't make it into Sorcerer.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if the guy she was dating was Mick Jagger. He's written some pretty nasty breakup songs.
Right. Well, I read that you wrote songs for Engelbert Humperdinck.
I did.
Yeah.
That is.
Yeah, this is wild, too. I want to get into that. But, okay, you were a songwriter. So what were you doing when you were writing songs?
I came out here as a songwriter and ended up meeting Engelbert and wrote two songs on Engelbert's album.
Two songs?
It was a song, We Live to Love and Somewhere in Time. I then met a man named Howard Hewitt, who is the lead singer of a group called Shalimar with Jody Watley. I'm aging myself. And I actually met Howard Hewitt at Hamburger Hamlet down the road. I thought he was somebody that I was picking up to be in a production crew, and I was a big fan of Howard's. He ended up taking a song of mine, and it went to number 3 on the R&B charts for a year.
Wow.
So I did quite well with Howard. And then I ended up selling a song to Simon Cowell's first artist named Sunita, and that album went top 10 throughout Europe.
Wow.
But I always thought people were much more talented than I in the music world. I love music. I just think it's great. But I couldn't believe I was doing well. And so I kind of segued into film because somebody hired me. Hired me originally in acquisitions, and then I just kept getting promoted, and I ended up on a film set.
So were you applying for, like, jobs at film companies, or did you meet someone?
I kind of met somebody. My whole life I'd fallen up. I don't know. I'm kind of lucky in that way. So I met somebody. They said they would teach me the business. Before I knew it, I was on a set. Probably shouldn't have been there, but I knew enough. And that kind of started my career, and that's the company where I met Graham King, who eventually became my partner.
Yeah, how did you start IEG? Now, how did that come about?
IEG...
Entertainment Group,
it
right?
It was Initial Entertainment Group.
Okay.
IEG was formed...
Initial, that's right. Image is another company.
Image is
right.
another company.
Yeah. Initial Entertainment Group.
Initial was formed originally... We're talking 15 years ago, and it was a very different time in the market. And at the time, interestingly, independent movies were usually $3 million and under.
Right.
They were very small, and anything kind of over $10 million were considered studio fare, believe it or not, at the time.
Yeah.
And then if you did a movie for $6 or $7 million, you were in no man's land. And there were only about two other companies that were doing these middle-of-the-road movies. Miramax was becoming its own. There was a company called, I just blanked on their name. They actually went out of business. And then Lakeshore started. And there was about three of us that were around at the time that the banks would pre-approve. And I kind of said, there's a niche in this market, and I want to be one of those guys. And so Graham and I talked. I had met various people in the industry. I went out and found our first film, which was Rent-A-Kid. We literally didn't even have a business plan. We went to the American film market with my one little film, Rent-A-Kid, and the rest was history. At that American film market, there was a magazine called Moving Pictures Magazine, and we made it on the cover as Initial Who, because we had sold more for that one film than any company around, but nobody knew who we were.
So when you sell the film, who are you selling it to at the American film market, for people who don't know what goes on there?
So Initial was a foreign distribution company, which means that outside of usually America and Canada, or, you know, the rest of the world is available, and you go to foreign distribution companies to then start selling your film all around the world. And that's what the American film market basically is all about. It's all these different buyers from everywhere coming to see which films that they're buying.
Did you have any? So was the film already made, or did you have anyone attached at the time? Or
we bought into that film when it was in the course of being made. They had run out of money, and I came in and I bought the foreign rights to that film.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and that film starred Leslie Nielsen.
Leslie Nielsen, Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, Chris Lloyd. Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he was great. And we went on and got an Emmy nomination for that film.
Yeah.
And that was our first film. So it was,
And then you moved on. Was your second film, If These Walls Could Talk?
Second film.
So what happens? Do you go to HBO prepared to do this, or did you make it first and then take it to HBO? What was the process? And how'd you get that cast?
Right.
Because that's a great cast.
HBO New York City came to us, actually.
Wow.
If These Walls Could Talk was a project that not many people wanted. I mean, it was three short stories about abortion. And to be honest with you, even my partner at the time said, oh, my God, you're going to bankrupt our company. He thought it was horrible. And the Todd sisters were putting it together with HBO New York City. I just thought Demi Moore at that time, if you remember, was about to be the highest paid actress.
G.I. Jane,
in the
right?
World.
And Striptease.
Striptease.
Right, yeah.
And she had just announced she was about to make $12 million a movie, which was unheard of.
Yeah,
right.
And we were making If These Walls Could Talk for $6 million. And I just thought, how can I lose? If this woman's making $12 million a movie and I've got the last time she's going to take a lower price, I have to do this. And we went on and we got a second Emmy nomination and a Golden Globe and a People's Choice.
And that was a huge movie.
It was a huge movie.
It did really well on DVD, too, did it not?
Yeah, the movie was great.
Yeah, yeah, women loved that movie. I don't know. I don't know many men that have seen it. It was a pretty... I think we're on Sunset Boulevard, yeah. Welcome to Detroit-style Coney Dog, where where someone is dead every 5 minutes.
Right.
No, I'm just kidding.
Damn, Viper Room.
The Viper Room.
We were
talking about this place outside with Cindy, because she came by here once, you said?
Mm-hmm.
And we were just talking about how good the food is, and we always talk about how good the food is, but the atmosphere is great, too. But what makes some of the atmosphere is sometimes we have fire trucks that go by all the time.
Yeah.
Is the fire station like down the block or something?
I don't know where it is.
They always come up Clark. Here we go. Here we go. It's coming. Yeah. 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 There it is. There it is. They always come up and down Clark.
Yeah.
It must be the easy way around. Okay. So after These Walls Could Talk, was it Savior that was next? Or did you do something in between that?
Gosh, I can't remember. We're going back in time. We did do a couple of more movies. Initial was an interesting company because we were never supposed to do as well as we did. And I say that modestly. And
well, that's how you felt about your music career, though.
Yeah,
too.
I know. I said we kind of fall up. Shortly after we did those two movies, we got approached by a bank and a man that I'd like to say started my career, which was a man named John Miller, who, when we only had... I think three movies to our name, came and gave us a $25 million line of credit.
Wow.
And those things don't really happen nowadays either. It was just kind of this fluke. He ran Chase Bank. He had only backed, I think, two other companies, and they were of the ilk of Miramax. And for some reason, he believed in us. We were very small. And he turned around and gave us a $25 million line of credit, and that really kind of started us.
Yeah, yeah. Because after that, what did you do, Dr. T and the Women with Robert Altman?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Savior came at some point. Savior was with Oliver Stone, and it was Dennis Quaid and Stellan Skarsgård, who's brilliant.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Were you on the set a lot for that film?
I was in Serbia for...
How was that? Because it's a serious picture, but I know Dennis is a funny guy.
Yeah, so, there was nothing funny about that movie.
No, not even off on the set, there's nothing funny going on.
There were great Savior stories. The first day of our shoot, the Milosevic government did an uprising, and we were caught in the middle of the war. People were calling from all over trying to find me because I kind of got lost from everybody. I had landed that day, and the news background in me, I ended up taking photos with the students uprising in the middle of the street. And so...
Wow.
We instantly had to move out of Bulgaria, which was the capital of Serbia, and we moved to a very small area called Podgorica. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. And that's where we did our shoot. It was, you know, it was a very hard shoot. For all of you who have not seen it, it was based on a real-life story.
Yeah.
And I have to say I'm incredibly proud of that movie, and it's an incredibly difficult movie.
Yeah.
But we ended up winning the equivalent to the United Nations Award for that film, and you know it's brutal. It's a
powerful
movie. It's powerful.
Yeah, it really is. And I was going to ask you, do you still have the pictures from that when you were
I do. Oh my God, it was amazing.
That's
and I have to say I think it was Dennis's best work.
Yeah,
I really do.
Yeah, Dennis did really well in it, and he's one of those guys that I think is kind of underrated. Like he's really good.
Yeah.
He's really good.
Right.
I've talked to him about it. He knows. He's good. He knows he's good. And then I like Dr. T and the Women.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys killed it with Farrah Fawcett in that movie, I want to say.
Yeah.
She was great in that
picture. She was good.
And Richard Gere was great. Mm-hmm. And so how involved were you in that movie from the inception? Because this is Robert Altman.
Right.
We know he's got to have control over. I mean, you've worked with some directors who like control.
You know,
they don't want people getting involved in their work.
Right.
So what is it like working on Dr. T and the Women? What was the whole process like with that?
Dr. T was great. I loved Robert Altman. That was a man that kind of shaped my career, and I have to say I'm blessed to have worked with. And Robert's movies were quirky, but I loved them, and you know I'm proud of that film too. at the time that we did Dr. T, it was a bit stressful because we also had Savior going, and the war was broken out, and it was an incredibly difficult movie. And we had also greenlit My Baby, which was a movie called Very Bad Things.
I love Very Bad Things.
Thank you.
Did you see Very Bad Things with Christian Slater, Daniel Stern, Jeremy Piven? Yeah, I love it. That is a movie I grew up, and I wanted to make movies like that. Dark but funny. Cameron Diaz had a role in it. She played Slater's wife, right?
Yeah. Jean Triplehorn.
Good movie.
Yeah, it was
great. So Dr. T and the women, you're filming that at the same time.
Simultaneous to Dr. T going, I spent about a year, and this is when producing gets kind of fun and kind of not. I lost all time zones. I went from Serbia to Dallas, Texas to Los Angeles, and it was quite a difficult time. I look back and think I wouldn't have changed it, but it was an interesting time. Very Bad Things was Peter Berg's first. He had never, you know, directed a movie before. I love Christian Slater, but he got arrested on my first day of my shoot. So we had to deal with some issues from that. And I love Christian. I'd work with him again in a second. But there were some challenges of doing those three movies at the same time.
Especially with those two directors, though, too. That's got to be wild. And then you're flying back. So were you saying you were a little happier when you were on set in Dallas than in Serbia, though? It was a little nicer?
Serbia was a bit difficult, especially being a girl. I mean, the Serbian mentality is I don't think they wanted a female around. Most of my days were spent being lectured by people asking me why I wasn't home pregnant, you know, with a man. So it was, you know, there's a reality check there.
If you are here now, who is cooking dinner for the man?
It's difficult.
I wanted to ask you, because you have done a lot of movies where there just happens to be maybe Very Bad Things not included so much, but strong women characters. Is that on purpose? Is that just something that's just coincidentally happened? Because it's great how many great women roles are in your films.
It's not on purpose, although I probably gravitate to it. You know, we're always just looking for good material, and I guess I can't be pigeonholed because my material, even if you just look at Dr. T and the Woman and Savior and Very Bad Things, they're incredibly different. Very Bad Things was my baby. That's a movie that a lot of people wouldn't have touched, and I just read and fell in love with. I remember I went to Fox to meet Peter Berg. He had never met me before, and I love telling my Peter Berg story because I went to this set of Chicago Hope, and he was dressed as Elvis. I don't even know how I got to his trailer, but I made it there, knocked on his door. He was like, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "The person who's going to finance your film." And we ended up taking this meeting, had a love fest with each other. Peter and I were both very talent connected, and that movie was a blast because it was all of our friends. So we just called in everybody. And
at this point, how do you know Peter Berg's going to be a great director and you wanted him to direct this film? Because he hadn't done really
anything. He hadn't done anything.
No, nothing directing-wise. Right. But he worked with some greats, Copland, with James Mangold.
Right, he did.
And he had Chicago Hope for many years. But at this point, how do you know? You're like, I'm going to give Peter the ball here.
As a producer, I think a lot of times you can just sit with somebody and know how they're going to be with actors. I mean, you know, if you surround them with a really good DP and you've got a good editor and you've got the, you know, the foundation to build a house, you can do it. And Peter was so smart. I have to say, I am so proud to say that I was there at the beginning of his career.
Yeah.
You know, I honestly love that man, and his career speaks for itself.
Huge. Yeah. Huge.
And, you know, for any of you listeners that don't know, we also had Jon Favreau.
Yep, Jon Favreau.
Nobody even really knew Jon except for Swingers, which I was a huge fan of.
He was great. He's funny.
But, so I like to say that I was there at the beginning of Jon's career, too.
Yeah.
So Very Bad Things definitely had a life of its own. And I have to tell you, it was a blast. Out of any movie I've done, it was the most fun.
And I've heard Jon talk about the movie. He loved it.
Yes, it was great.
He loved doing it, and he learned a lot working with Peter, which is funny because it was Peter's first film. And I remember hearing him talk about it. He worked with David Anspaugh on Rudy and then Very Bad Things.
Right.
And then he said he learned a lot from just watching these guys. So it played a role in Jon's directing, too, which is great. I did want to talk about this leads me to Traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this, though. It gives me a really good feeling to hear you say that you gravitate towards good material that you care about making the best possible movie you can. Otherwise, instead of just being about trying to see what's going to be the biggest hit or the thing that's going to get you the like
and very
caring
bad
about
things
the material.
With hard R. I mean, that was not a popular movie to do at that time.
But I'm just saying, like the respect that you have for like the quality of it versus it seeing where you could do business is really, I think it flies in the face of the misconception that a lot of people who aren't familiar with the business or don't live anywhere near Hollywood might have of like a crass, cigar chomping industry player type producer. And it doesn't sound like you or anyone you work with adheres to that.
And I think listeners of our show have seen that it's not, they've heard it's not as much like that. We've had on some very good people who just like to do good work. You know, they like to do stuff that they're in love with.
Right.
And I wanted to talk about Traffic, because I think Traffic is one of those films that is going to be one of the greatest films of our time. Like when how we look back 40 years ago on, you know, we're watching Nicholas Ray movies yesterday or Coppola. Or I think people are going to look back on Soderbergh's Traffic and go, this was a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
How involved were you at the beginning? Is this your movie? Are you now? What's the casting process like? Because you have an amazing cast. Once again, great female roles in it. Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Right.
That's her best work by far. She's amazing in that movie. So what was this like putting together Traffic? And did you kind of know where it was leading?
No. And Traffic was one of those interesting stories in Hollywood that you hear some people talk about. I decided after the year of doing those three movies that I needed a break. And in the 5 years that I had initial, we either bought, financed, or produced almost 20 movies. And I was still trying to maintain a semblance of a love life or a social life, and it was quite difficult. I mean, people think that when the cameras stop rolling, you're done for the day. And as a producer, you know, we all know, we're in an editing room, and when the film is done, now I've got to make sure that delivery requirements are met. And then I've got to get the next film going. And, you know, there's bank closings. There's all the different facets of producing that some people don't realize exist. And so at the time, I actually had an engagement falling apart from a boyfriend who was a little pissed off that I was traveling around the world without him. And I decided that there was a needed break that needed to be done. And so I set about to find a film that would help me raise the sale price of my company. And believe it or not, Traffic had been out there, I want to say, for over 7 years.
Wow.
It's one of those movies where there is a script that is good, but nobody's giving
now,
it.
Now, did Stephen Goggin write this one that was 7 years prior?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was just sitting out there.
It was just sitting there. It was a very, you know, again, it was a difficult movie. You know, the very bad things and the saviors and the traffics. You know, in retrospect, everybody's like, how'd you know? And it was great. But it was a movie about drug smuggling, and people were afraid of it. Saying that, when the movie first came to me, it had many incarnations. There was a Nicolas Cage incarnation.
Wow.
There was a Tommy Lee Jones incarnation. There was a couple of different...
Tommy was the Michael Douglas character.
There was a couple of different incarnations before it became Michael Douglas. And although I was involved with the film for bringing it in, and it helped me sell the film and ultimately sell my company, it was the end of my era at Initial. Sadly, I then wasn't there for the completion of the process because I then sold the company on it.
Were you involved in the hiring of Soderbergh?
Soderbergh was attached.
He was already attached.
But remember that Soderbergh wasn't Soderbergh either.
Right. Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and that was about
that was it.
Well, everyone was mentioning his name after that movie because he had Aaron Brockovich in the same year.
Sure.
I think.
Yeah.
I think Aaron Brockovich was afterwards.
Yeah, it was after, It was like a year or two after, But, I mean, he was hot then. But this is the movie that got him hot because it was filmed in a way that mainstream films weren't filmed in, especially in America.
Right.
And, it got him really hot. I mean, the style of the film is also just as great as the script, as the acting. So you really did a good job with that. All right. So then you take some time off. But tell me this, because I'm having this problem, and I'm not nearly as busy as you. How do you balance the professional life and the personal life? How do you do that?
Yeah.
Like, because you're really busy. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even half as busy, and I can't do it.
Yeah,
right.
This is the learning part of the show for
yes.
Matt and me.
Yes, this is me.
I'm not sure if I'm the right person to ask, considering I'm recently single again. It's difficult. I will say, I think that's one of the challenges of our business. We love the business, and God, I tried to leave it, and here I am back in it again. So there's a love that we have with it. As a female, I think it's more difficult because I'm asking a guy to understand why I'm leaving for 3 months. And I
think most guys would like that.
So, I mean, it is difficult. And I try not to make my life 100% about the business all the time, because I think you can also get very lost in a minutia of our business. And I like to think that there is more.
It is kind of a fantasy land, our business.
It really
is. And you do get lost in it.
It is.
You do. And it's easy to get lost in it.
You think you're saving, like, the world. You're, like, doing world peace.
Well, you try to say to yourself, my career is not going to be the most important thing to my life as a big deal. And it's very hard because people don't,
it's hard.
Other people don't see it that way.
This go round, I'd like to say that I'm really trying to give a balance.
Yeah.
You know, I just think it's really important.
Well, you know, it's just funny, too, because I know if my mom told my dad I got to leave for 3 months, my dad would have, a confetti everywhere.
He'd be like, all right.
Popping champagne bottles.
Yeah.
Men are very insecure out here.
Yeah. My dad would be popping champagne bottles. He'd be like, all right, have fun.
Yeah, see ya. Yeah. See ya. Don't forget to write. All right, so talk to me then. You took a break, right? Mm-hmm. How'd you get back involved? What did you do on your break? Was there any life-changing experiences, any big moments, or did you just decide, I want to go back to work?
No, I took the break, I guess the infamous year off, which stretched longer. I got the house in Beverly Hills. I got, the boyfriend at the time. I traveled the world, and then I got bored. the problem with me that I found was I had done really well, and I sold a company. I started and sold a company and had done incredibly well, and a lot of my friends hadn't. And so I spent a couple of years paying for everybody to come on trips with me, which, by the way, was great, and I would. But then there comes a time, though, with, wow, wait, maybe I should stop. And honestly, I saw the business going into a different format, which is going into now. I mean, unfortunately for the new producers that are coming up now, people frequently say it's harder, and it is a harder time. It's much harder today than it was back then. Mm-hmm. Saying that, I also think that there's opportunities to get into the business now that there never were before.
Right.
We had that conversation the other day.
Yeah, and I think there is. And so I started having some really big producers coming to me and saying, could I help them put their films back together? And by the way, going back to Robert Altman, he's probably the reason I got back in the business. Before Bob died, I had gotten a phone call from him and his producing partner asking if I would come back out of retirement to do a movie with him. And I was so honored. He had just gotten a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah.
It had been years since I had worked with him, and I was just incredibly honored that he was coming back to me. Yeah. And we actually were putting that movie together when he passed away, which was unfortunate. But that got me to thinking, wow, maybe it is time to come back. And then I had some other very big producers approaching me also. And I realized, and I had this conversation with someone today, there's not that many producers that know the foreign market as far as distribution and the financing market as far as banking and the actual on-set producing. And while I don't think I'm maybe the best in any of the three, I think I'm a real triple threat because I know all three.
Yeah.
So in the climate of the business today, you almost need to know these things.
You need that.
And so it's interesting. Red Lights is my first movie back, and it was to show people that I'm still actor friendly. And in all of my movies, you'll see big name talents. I enjoy them. I respect them. I love working with them. Mm-hmm. And so Red Lights was a way to say, I'm back. I'll take a chance on this other director. I saw Buried. I was blown away.
Yeah.
And we're off to the races again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let's talk about Red Light, because here were you involved at the beginning?
Yes.
Okay. So you're involved at the beginning. You get this script. First, what attracted you to the script?
So UTA sent me the script. It was sent from Rena Ronson at UTA, and she said, would I look at this? And I read the script, and I love things that deal with the paranormal. I just, it's one of the areas that I think is fascinating. And so I read the script, and then UTA set up a screening of a film that not many people had seen at that moment in time, which was Buried. And
with Ryan Reynolds.
It was incredible. I remember thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to be bored out of my mind. How am I going to watch a movie with one guy buried in a box for 2 hours?
And with Ryan's best work.
Yeah, he was great.
If anybody hasn't seen it, I should be Rodrigo's biggest supporter. The movie is genius. And I walked out of that and said, I'm in.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah. So at that point, you have the script. You have Rodrigo in your corner. Okay. Casting. Robert De Niro is one of the greatest actors of all time, someone you had not have worked with yet.
Right.
Did you know Robert, like, before you worked with him, or what made you go to him? What was the process
Bob
like
and I
that?
Had met a couple of times, but I won't say he was in my best friend category.
Right.
Actually, Sigourney and I almost worked together about 8 years ago.
She's great.
She's amazing, and, God, her stories are legendary. One of my favorite things on this set was listening to Sigourney talk about movies like Gorillas in the Mist.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's one thing to go into Aliens and, you know, she's the first, I think, female superhero in Aliens. But Gorillas in the Mist, to listen how they shot that movie where it was only her and the DP allowed around these gorillas and they'd sit there for months to get one shot. We don't do movies like that nowadays.
No.
Nowadays we green screen them and, you know, CGI them and do all these kind of things. So it was really fascinating.
This was in the days before they invented Andy Serkis.
Yeah, right?
Well, that was a Peter Guber movie, too.
That's right.
Gorillas in the Mist, yeah.
So we hired a casting director, and props to Rona Kress for this film. And Rona's the one who started putting together the cast list. And based on the cast list that was coming, we were able to do what I was talking about a second ago, do the foreign numbers that I felt worked. A company called Parlay Films then came on board as the foreign distributor. Parlay was great. We built the waterfall, which means that you can show an investor how they're going to make their money back. It was great because, oh my God, I should also be part of the Barcelona Tourism Board. It was probably the most romantic and amazing place to shoot. And then we were talking a second ago before we got on mic. Rana did something which is amazing, and she found us Elizabeth Olsen. And I have to say, we got so lucky. It was right before Sundance and right before that movie hit. And Lizzie is probably one of my favorite young actors I've ever worked with.
Sure.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, I heard she's great. And so let me ask you about this whole foreign market thing.
Yes.
Okay. How did you know you're going to make money back off this film? How'd you show the investors this, one? And then the other thing is, as someone who knows the foreign market, what's the foreign market looking for that maybe we don't necessarily look for in America? What's hot over there? What is they like?
That's a good question, man.
The thing that I like to tell a lot of writers, for all of you writers out there, when you're doing a movie that you think works in the foreign market, imagine shooting a film that then you turn the volume off. And this is the honest to God's truth. A lot of people don't realize that we have to dub that movie in every single language. And sometimes movies don't translate. So a lot of times you'll see these movies in America and it's the art house movies. And by the way, they could be magnificent, but they're art house movies that are geared to America and they've got dialogue that is very American and it's two people sitting in a house with huge monologues. Those movies don't work typically overseas because when you dub them, the translation goes out the window. So we look for movies that we know have a common theme. Paranormal phenomena is everywhere.
Sure.
So I will look for thrillers. Thrillers always work for me. If it's comedies, I want them to be very broad comedies.
Yeah.
If it's horror, and we're not going to get so much into the horror, but by the way, there's a reason these found footage movies are working, and props to all of them that are coming out. These found footage movies, that people think are real, those translate everywhere.
They do really well for foreign markets.
They do absolutely amazing. Yeah. Sci-fi does well everywhere. So we look for, my company looks for movies that I know we can translate into anywhere and that there's a common theme that everybody can relate to.
So tell me this. Okay, for the comedians that listen to the show and for comedy writers, okay, when you say a broad comedy, do you mean like an Adam Sandler type of film, or do you mean something, like what do you mean by broad comedy?
Going back to Very Bad Things could have been very chancy for me. Very Bad Things was a broad comedy that could have not worked because, look, the good about Very Bad Things were I was a gross-out film, to tell you the truth. And I have to say one of my proudest moments was when Very Bad Thing, I was told that my film and, God, I can't even remember what the other film was at the time. There was two of us that we were told offended everybody. So I'll take that proudly, by the way.
I think when the prostitute dies, it's a little offensive.
Everybody's got prostitutes. Right. Everybody's got whatever. But
stop with the spoilers.
Oh yeah, sorry.
That movie could have failed.
14 years old.
Right.
That movie could have failed because some of the jokes were a little perfect for America and might not have translated. Movies like The Hangover will translate everywhere.
Right.
Movies like Bridesmaids. There's a reason that people are looking for certain movies right now. You can go back to Animal House.
Yeah.
Those movies translate everywhere. They're broad comedies. They're physical.
Yeah.
You can watch, you know, again, turn the volume down and watch them. And I promise you that if you're home one night, late at night, and inebriated or elsewhere, and the volume's down on Hangover, you're going to laugh your ass off anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think that summed it up really well.
Yeah.
I think if you couldn't understand that, you probably shouldn't be writing. All right. So tell me more about Red Lights. Okay. So you film this movie. It's a thriller. It's a horror movie. Suspense. What? All those things.
We're a thriller. We're a thinking man's thriller. I don't want anybody to think they're going to walk into a slasher movie because they're not. If I were to compare how I would like this movie to be marketed, it's Sixth Sense.
Okay.
It's, you know, a movie that you will go in thinking about and come out hopefully thinking about as well.
Is this a PG-13, an R-rated?
No, I think we're PG-13.
Okay, so what's the? Give us a synopsis in your words. What are we looking at with this movie? We got the paranormal aspect.
Right. In a nutshell, what this movie is, Sigourney Weaver is a professor at a college. Killian is her second, and she spends the first act of this movie debunking anything paranormal. You think that she is just filled with hatred of anything in this world, and she does debunk most of what she comes in contact with until she meets somebody that she can't.
Yeah.
And then it goes into this whole thing, is this real or is this not?
Is that
not
the De Niro character?
That is the De Niro character.
Okay.
And then I can't tell you who or what comes after that.
No, don't. Okay.
There's
don't
a spoiler alert.
Really no,
fun.
Don't give it away.
Here's what I love about that, though. First, you got Sigourney Weaver debunking paranormal after two Ghostbusters films,
right.
Four Aliens
right.
films. Okay? I think that's great. I think that's great. Also, it sounds to me, I like her playing a professor because even though she didn't so much, remember Copycat, mm-hmm. which she was great in? I love her in those kind of roles. Intellectual, like she plays
working
a really
girl.
Smart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. She could play smart better than anybody. She's great. So that sounds great. Now, what else? This is premiering at Sundance.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get the call for this? Like, and how excited were you? What was this like? Did you call them and tell them we have this film, we just want to premiere it there, or we just want whenever, but they tell you opening night. So explain
yeah,
that.
No, I got incredibly lucky. I had actually just gone home. I hadn't been back to see my family in over a year, and it happened to be a night that I was sitting with my whole family in Hollywood, Florida, and I got the text message from UTA saying Sundance wants us. And that was exciting enough, and
sure.
to be sharing it with my whole family. But then I was told not only does Sundance want us, but we're the big Friday night premiere. We're at the Eccles. There's 2,000 seats, and they want us.
Right.
So it was amazing.
That's great because Rodrigo's movie Barry did really mm-hmm. well there. It was one of the big films to come out of Sundance. And then you got De Niro.
Right.
And then you got Sigourney. It's and Elizabeth Olsen
yeah.
who's really hot right now. So you got this great movie to open up Sundance.
Right.
I don't know if Sundance has had an opening this big in a few years.
Right.
Because you got some really hot talent in
right.
this movie. So that's great. And
I want to give props to Killian, by the
yeah.
way.
Killian Murphy.
Killian
yeah.
has an Oscar in him at some point. And Even my insignificant roles in this movie, Toby Jones, I don't know if anybody saw.
Oh, yes. Toby Jones is
Toby
good.
Played Truman Capote, and if anybody didn't see that one because it was overshadowed by the other, he's brilliant. And
he's
coming out in Hunger Games. Jolie Richardson is, you know, obviously in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
I love Jolie.
So, yeah, you know.
She was great on Nip Talk. She's really good. She's
great.
Really good.
Toby Jones has been turning up a lot lately.
Yeah,
lot
well, I mean, he should be. He's a great character actor. He's really good in every role he does. Okay, all right. So you're going to take this to Sundance, and you're going to get distribution. Are we expecting to see it maybe like, what, you think fall? Probably October time, that'd be pretty good.
Yeah, we're definitely a fall movie. So typically, for those that don't know, when these movies go to the festivals, at least in the case of ours, nobody's seen this film. Literally, I was telling you guys, I think six people have seen it.
And probably all worked on it.
And they do.
Yeah.
Every one of us has worked on it. We've kept it very under wraps, not letting anybody have sneak previews or any of that.
Screeners.
No. One of the fun things about these festivals is seeing it for the first time with an audience and seeing it with your cast and having a Q&A with your director, and hopefully the buzz then starts, you know, where you do get some kind of a bidding war. And hopefully in a movie like this, it goes to a home that can roll it out properly.
So what I wanted to ask you about next was Miracle on 42nd Street, which you're in post-production of right now mm-hmm. as well. The cast is Alicia Keys, Sam Jackson, Terrence Howard. Who else is in it?
God, we are hoping to get Mickey Rourke, Patrick Dempsey. For those of you that don't know, this is a documentary that is incredibly close to my heart. There is a building in New York City called the Manhattan Plaza that was built at a time when Hell's Kitchen was at its worst, and they were trying to reinvigorate this area. And so they built this amazing building that's got indoor and outdoor swimming pools and tennis courts and sound stages. And it was built originally to try to get very wealthy people to come down to Hell's Kitchen. And, of course, once it was built, all the wealthy people said, great building, we're not moving there. And so the building sat empty for years. It was then somebody's brilliant idea to try to make it a building for the arts. And so actors, and I'm fascinated with this, actors and musicians actually auditioned for apartments. And it was known that they would get an apartment for free. And as they started to make money, the building would then commission them for monies that they were making for rent. And so all of these actors that are in our documentary, Alicia Keys and Terrence Howard, by the way, Seinfeld was created there. Larry David lived there, and the original Kramer was his next-door neighbor.
Wow.
All of these people lived in this building, and they took care of their own. At one point, this building, they tried to shut it down because it was the number one AIDS capital in the world per square footage. You had a lot of actors and a lot of musicians with a lot of free time.
Hey.
And thankfully, they all defended themselves and took care of their own, and they said, don't shut us down. We will take care of our own. And so what's beautiful about this building is anybody who works in the building started out as homeless. So there's pie shops, and there's all these unique restaurants and stuff that are in it that are now employing people that had nowhere to go. And it's our desire that once this documentary is done, that we can recreate it in as many states as we can, and that we can start this, you know, everywhere.
That's really cool.
That's something.
That's really cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. Do you know when that would be?
We're in the final legs of getting the talent. You know, we want as many of them that lived in it as we can. Hopefully it'll be done. Documentaries are so difficult because we all do them in our free time. But I would love to say that hopefully it'll be done in the next 6 months, and then
it'll be
for next year.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, now I want to ask you about this. You just recently started doing TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
You were never really a big television producer. What made you get into television? Because you got a show with FX that we were talking about you just sold, mm-hmm. and you got a couple other shows you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you get into television? Why? What do you look for differently with television projects than film projects? What's that process for you?
I love TV nowadays. I have to tell you that I have never seen television at its best like it is right now.
Right.
There are TV shows like Game of Thrones, or I don't know if any of you guys have seen Homeland. I spent all weekend watching all 12 episodes.
I've only seen the first. I have to see the rest.
Oh, my God. They're brilliant.
Yeah.
Or fun shows like True Blood or Walking Dead, which has all of my friends on it.
Oh, yeah?
I became a TV fanatic, which I never thought that I would before. And again, the business is changing as far as the film business. You guys asked me about my personal life once before. I'd like to get into TV, maybe to try to have one so I can stay home a little bit more if possible, unless, of course, I end up shooting somewhere else. But I'm just fascinated with TV. I've developed a love for it, and so I just can't wait. It's a medium that I'm truly excited to be a part of.
That's great. Well, then let's sum it up with the with Red Light here. All right, so that is going to be at Sundance. That's next Friday.
Yes.
That's next. So you're going to Park City, right?
Yeah.
When are you leaving? Next week?
I'm leaving next Thursday.
Next Thursday, flying in. Now, hopefully someone's driving you.
Yeah, right.
You're right.
I don't want you driving out there.
No, thanks.
We're looking forward to it, though, and that should be in theaters this fall. Thanks. I'm looking forward to see who buys it. I'm sure they're going to spend a few dollars on it. It sounds like a great project.
Thank you.
And I'm really looking forward to it. And, Cindy, I'm so happy you did the show.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It was great.
I'd love to have you on again when the movie's
Absolutely.
Coming out.
I learned a lot.
Talk about it. Yeah. It was pretty educational.
It was our educational.
Not so funny. Of course,
I'll be funny next time, I swear.
No, with Lee and I on the show, it's never really that
Okay, great.
No.
Well, you guys make sure I'm your Facebook buddies. Now I'm like listening to you guys going, wait, I didn't get my invite.
Oh, yeah.
Are you on the Facebook?
I am on Facebook.
Oh, we're all on the Facebook.
I only take people that I know, but now I know you guys. So.
That's how I met Andrew and Patty on the Facebook. And I want to thank Andrew and Patty Friedman and Brian DeCastro for letting us have you on the show and talking to you. I was really looking forward to it. I was really excited about it. That's great. I really appreciate everything, and thank you for doing it. And we'd love to have you on again.
Yeah, thanks, you guys.
Great.
Thank
All
you,
right.
Sydney.
Red Light premiering at Sundance next Friday night, and then you'll be seeing it this fall with Robert De Niro, Sigourney Weaver, Cillian Murphy, and Elizabeth Olsen. I hear you just fine. I love how you got to hear yourself better.
Okay.
Lee has this thing where he has to turn up the volume on his mic if he doesn't hear him.
Well, here's what I thought of Cindy.
Yes, Lee, please.
I was struck by how modest she was.
Intelligent.
I guess people who produce movies generally, if you don't know anything about the business, you just have this image of them as being a certain way, and she was like not that way.
No,
not
at all.
Any of those ways. And she's like a high-powered producer.
Not at all. You know what I want to talk about? First of all, I'm so happy to finally understand the foreign market a lot better.
Yeah.
Second of all, I'm really looking forward to that movie because everyone hot is in that movie right now, it seems. It's just a hot movie. But I also want to talk about yesterday, our Looney Tunes cartoons.
Oh, yes. What's up? So yesterday we rented from the wonderful Cinephile.
Santa Monica and Sawtelle.
Mm-hmm. Which is a wonderful selection. A collection of uncensored Warner Brothers cartoons. And they're uncensored. They're presented this way mainly for the reason that they're racist, mostly. But they're... To put it another way, I'd say politically incorrect. Yes. Some of them are racist, flat out racist.
Some of them are propaganda.
A lot of them are propaganda, like World War II propaganda, where like you know they're hitting Hitler on the head with a mallet and all that.
Sure.
Boyle,
there was that one cartoon where the Hitler character goes on for like 3 minutes.
Yes.
And we're like, we get it.
And he's, we get it, yeah. And that opens the movie. And he's like saying every...
Not as good as Nazi Spies.
He's
the
saying...
The Stooges short watched.
Right, we watched that right before. We had a really cultured evening.
We had a very 1940s evening.
It starts off and Hitler is just screaming in the cartoon. And he's saying every German word that Americans know. Liverwurst, Bratwurst, and
Sauerkraut.
And then you're laughing, and you're like, okay.
Not Mel Blanc's finest moment.
Get to the TNT and the lumps on the head.
There was no TNT in any of those cartoons.
No.
Oh, my God. That Bugs Bunny nips the nips.
Yeah. That
had
was the
most offensive cartoon I ever seen.
Right. That was probably one of the most offensive cartoons I've ever seen.
So offensive.
And that, let me tell you something. That is the name of the cartoon that we just named. We are not being...
I'm not being racist.
It's called Bugs Bunny Nips the Nips. And he's on an island
As soon as the title came up, I look at Lee and I go, oh, boy, here we go.
He's on an island in the Pacific. There's the rising sun flag is there, and then the rest of it is...
Sumo wrestlers.
Sumo wrestlers.
There's the...
There's a crude...
Quote, Togo.
Togo. There's a Tojo, yes.
The Tojo,
Tojo,
yeah.
Tojo character, and then there's the...
I love how he named a sandwich shop.
Right.
Instead. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, it was... I got to tell you, though, these cartoons are great because you won't see them anywhere else. Well, there was this one cartoon where we're like, why is this banned? Why is this censored?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then
that was, yeah, yeah.
The gremlin's going to fly into the Twin Towers.
Right. No, it's the Empire State Building.
Or was it the Empire State? Yep. And we're like, oh, there it is.
And that's a cartoon. It's called Falling Hair,
yeah.
If you want to watch it. It's a cartoon.
With Bugs Bunny and
a gremlin, which was like a saboteur of
aircraft.
Gremlins
from the Kremlin.
Right, a saboteur of aircraft from the war. And we're like, well, this is nothing. And then it looks like the gremlin's going to fly the plane into the building, which is... yeah, it's good. And there was another cartoon where we're like, oh, this is funny. This is like a funny Bugs Bunny cartoon. How is this racist? Like, there's one of those ugly caricatures for, like, you know, southern black people that they had, you know.
Yeah.
And then we're like, what? How is this? And then at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was always for, like, 7 of the 9 cartoons. We didn't know why they were censored until the last
show. Very last thing. And that one was called All This and Rabbit
Stew. Was that
Stew.
The dice bit?
Yeah.
Oh.
So in the end, Bugs Bunny foils his pursuer by persuading him to start a dice game. That's
yeah.
what it was.
Yeah. And they, and then there was another one where they used the
dice
game.
Yeah, the other one they used the dice. Yeah.
And then in the last one, the Snow White one, the guy had dice for teeth.
Yeah, he had dice for teeth. And that one was called Snow White and the Seven Dwarves
with a
B.
Yeah. Seven Dwarves.
That one was, but that was kind of an amazing cartoon.
Goldilocks and the Jivin' Bears.
Goldilocks and the Jivin' Bears. And the other one was called Angel Puss, which is a dark, dark cartoon.
Not funny at all.
And the one with Bugs Bunny and the dice game at the end, which is kind of funny until that happens, is called All This and Rabbit Stew.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did that. We watched some Stooges. We love the Stooges,
yeah.
You and I.
We've been watching, so for those listening, Matt and I have been watching the Stooges before we go to bed, before we go to sleep, like the last, like 3 times this week.
Yeah, and it's been great.
It's great, yeah.
You go to bed on a high note, you feel good.
Because I have some Stooges volumes on DVD, and Cinephile had some other ones, and they had the racist World War II era ones. That,
yeah.
You know, so we're getting a good dose of hilarious World War II era racism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. What else is going on that we could... Oh, I wanted to talk about James Franco for a minute.
Okay.
He has a film coming out. Where I guess he plays a gay guy, and he blows a dude in it. And people are wondering whether it is for shock value or he's trying to do art pieces. Because this is not the first time James has done something to get attention.
Well...
What do you think of movies like this? Because remember, Vincent
Gallo with the Brown Bunny and Chloe Sevigny really did it on camera.
No, he does it on camera.
Yeah, okay. Well, that scene was not as shocking because it came in the context of the movie, and yeah. You know, Vincent found a way to make it about the movie. It's still something that I don't know if showing it in full detail is necessary to the story or not. I don't really care. It doesn't bother me, that kind of stuff, but it's, you know. But James, a little different.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there was one movie... where there are these cowboys, and they have one scene where they're making out, and you can't see it that well.
Yeah, and everyone flipped out about it.
And people lost their shit.
Yeah.
What did you see in that movie? I don't even remember that scene.
To be honest with you, I don't remember anything explicit about Brokeback Mountain.
No.
And I'm not saying that to be facetious. By the way, I do want to wish feature contributor Lenny Cannata happy birthday tomorrow.
Yes, it's his birthday tomorrow.
Leonard Cannata turns 29 years of age. Mm-hmm. That is tomorrow. Lenny's birthday, Chicago celebrate. I'm sure they're throwing a parade. I really enjoyed that interview.
I did too.
That was probably, that's up there in my top five mm-hmm. that we've done. It is. And the top five has little to do with me and more to do with the guests.
Right.
I was thinking about today. Chris McDonald was great. Josh Molina was great. Michael Ian Black was great. You know, every time we have Peter Tolan on it.
Right. Shelley Leibowitz.
Shelley Leibowitz is great. And Cindy's right up there as one of the greats we've had on.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. I really am going to be promoting this show because I really want a lot. I promote every show, but like overboard on this because I want people to hear this. I think
you
really
and I
smart...
were both learning so much that we couldn't make any jokes.
Well, my brain's kind of dead.
I know.
I felt like it was a fun interview, and we had some funny stuff going on, but I felt educated for an hour.
I did, too.
So, I don't know. We do have shows coming up soon. We'll keep you updated on that. I don't know who's booked for next week yet. We'll figure it out. We'll let you know. I'm a little behind with my life at the moment.
Yeah, right, right.
I don't really have one.
In the coming months, though, we've got some very interesting shows coming up. But the next few weeks, going to be seeing who we get on in terms of a guest.
Yeah, so we're going to call Ronnie on our next show, I promise. For our listeners who love Ronnie Lott.
Well, you want to do some news?
I feel like I'm going to be doing the news like Peter Jennings now. I feel like I'm just going to be too serious.
That's just it.
I couldn't even do anything about that James Franco bit. There was nothing for me to do. It was just not funny for me now.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Cindy Cohen. Red Light is going to be premiering at Sundance next Friday. Big movie, Robert De Niro, Sigourney Weaver, Cillian Murphy, and Elizabeth Olsen. Rodrigo Cortez directed it. He did Buried with Ryan Reynolds. I hear it's already sold out.
Yeah.
You're excited for the movie?
Yeah, I am very interested.
Yeah, me too. So
my family watches those ghost shows, paranormal hunters and all that. Ghost hunters.
I like the plot for this movie.
My sister's like a nut for that stuff.
I like the plot for this. The paranormal aspect always turns me on.
Yeah.
And it's not a roving camera handheld.
Right. People walking in and out of
rooms.
Actual
movie.
Yeah.
I like that she said it's a thriller. We're not going to expect a cat to jump up on the dishwasher and scare you.
Right. So, or it was just a dream.
Yeah, or it was just a dream.
Where I died.
So, thank you very much to Cindy. Thank you very much to the Friedmans for bringing her here. Thank you very much to
Cindy for being so good in an interview that it rendered us completely helpless, unfunny.
I'm paralyzed.
Yeah.
Detroit-style Coney Dog, thank you. As usual, 8873 Sunset Boulevard here in West Hollywood. You can get your Coney Dogs. You can get your fudge. You can get your Faygo. You can get your chili and cheese fries. You can get great burgers.
You can choose from their very extensive beer selection.
Yeah, and my favorite, the Red Wings.
Yeah, the wings are good.
I love the wings. Mm-hmm. They're great. It's either that. I like the Dino, too. I can't really get into this right now. I can't even talk food.
I know.
I feel useless at
this
point.
I do.
I feel like when Cindy got off the show got 100 times dumber.
Right.
And now it's just, we need to leave it where it is.
Yeah.
Leave it be.
God.
So thank you very much to Cindy. We wish her the best of luck on her film, and we hope to have her on again.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much to our listeners. If you didn't hear the Kurtwood Smith episode on Monday, go back and listen to that.
Right.
That was on January 9th. Kurtwood Smith, who's Red on that 70s show, fantastic actor.
Mm-hmm.
He will be in Vanity Fair in March with Chris McDonald, Margot Martindale, Stephen Root, Richard Jenkins, huge list, great list, Gary Cole.
Yeah.
So, check that out. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. My name is Peter Jennings.
And I'm Diane Sawyer. Have a good weekend, everyone. We'll see you next week.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.